to Writers Off Topic, the podcast that takes a light-hearted dive into writing life with your hosts Craig Hallam and Miranda Dickinson. In this episode, the truth about book fairs and which of our characters we'd like to date. Well, hello and welcome to episode 4 of Writers Off Topic podcast, aka What Part. I am Miranda Dickinson. My co-host is the very lovely Mr. Craig Hallam. How are you, Craig Hallam?
I am extremely tired. How are you?
Craig's a new daddy. Craig's a new daddy. Tell us all about it, Craig.
Yes. So little Rosie was born on Monday and we're recording this on Sunday. So she is 7 days old. Bless her little face. And I'm just absolutely lost my mind.
Are you besotted?
I have. I'm infatuated. I am. I can't stop kissing a little face.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She smells so good.
Baby smell. It's all good.
Yeah, so I've actually completely and utterly lost my mind over the last week. Well, we were just talking before we hit record. I have been singing terrible songs, making up words to songs that I've forgotten the words to, just to do anything to kind of, you know, settle her and make her feel at home and make her feel comfy. And you're just aware the whole time that this is a brand spanking new human.
Yeah.
Loving every minute. However, for our patrons, I apologise. If you're watching the uncut video version of this episode, and I look like this. We've not had an episode for a while, have we? But that's because both of our lives have been a little bit like the tornado in Wizard of Oz, with just like cows just like flying past the window.
And you know what it was? It's because about two episodes ago, we went, we're pretty onto this now. We've got it pretty sorted and like everything's fine. And then life just went, no, it isn't.
So you've been like writing 14 books, editing another 12, publishing 3.
It feels like it, but it's actually only 2.
Is that all?
That sounds like part-time now, doesn't it? Oh, it's just 2. So I am doing a structural edit on Coral Ale Book 3, which is my third crime novel, which will be coming out in April, which now sounds quite scary close. Considering. I have had to do a bit of a major overhaul on it, so that's why my brain is just fried. It needed it. It definitely needed it. And there's a lot of stuff that I thought I'd put on the page that just isn't there. So I don't know where. Somewhere between my brain.
Does that happen to you? Yeah, I swear blind that I've written in a detail or like a little character quirk or a little piece of conversation that explains
it's really important. Yeah.
No, I haven't. It's stowed away in my brain and it never made it to my fingers. Yeah, I do it all the time.
Yeah. I knew what I'd got to do it. And I've worked with my editor, who's been brilliant. We had really good chats. But I talked to her once. I'd sat there for a week going, I don't know what to do. Because I wanted to come with answers and like suggestions.
Sure, all of
the stuff works. And it's great. It's just actually doing it now. So I've written a whole load of new scenes. And now I'm going through the manuscript and I'm just taking out bits that don't work and I'm putting the new scenes in.
Doing the crafting, as I always say. This is the crafting stage, isn't it? This is where you're
putting the glitter on the poo. No, I meant it to look like that from the beginning. I mean, this is the thing about editing, I think, is that if you do your job right, no one notices, like, which is as it should be. But there's part of you. I do wonder sometimes, you know, like people that build these motorways, like people built the M6 where it goes through like a valley and they had to just where you've got the little farm in the middle where it goes I often wonder if like for years afterwards the engineers just wanted to stop on the road and tell everybody in the car like, well, you think this looks easy, but this took us months to work out from that boulder to that boulder, you know.
Do you have any idea what we had to go through?
The M62
splits around that guy's farmhouse who refused to sell it.
Yeah. And they built tunnels for him to take his sheep and his cows.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah. We used to drive that way as kids because we used to go almost every weekend back up to Ilkley, which is where all my family are from, because that was where we saw all the family and everything.
Yeah.
So right the way up until I was about 6 or 7, we do it most weekends. So I'm so used to that bit of motorway. It feels like driving home, even though Black Country's home, but also Yorkshire's
home. Yeah.
That weird thing.
Wait, is this why you always wear a hat?
Yeah, because I'm from Ilkley Moor, see? You don't want to be bad hat on Ilkley Moor, so I've always got hat. On Ilkley Moor, we hat.
We have. So you've been editing. You've been editing rewrites.
And then I'm writing a first draft of. You know, when you just feel like you're not even in the year you're supposed to be in.
Yes.
And not in a good way, not in a Doctor Who way, like in a. Can I do that? We just like, jump in a TARDIS and just turn up when it's all done. That'd be brilliant. That wouldn't make for very good viewing. It'd be like, oh, flipping heck, she just jumps ahead 4 months where she's sent it in and now she's sleeping at a normal time. Not speaking gibberish. But yeah, so I'm writing the first draft of what will be my 2024 novel, which is my rom-com. And this is one that's set in Stratford-upon-Avon, which is just about an hour away from me. It's one of my favourite places in the world.
Oh, and yeah, this is your real, like, Shakespearean...
It's got a Shakespearean twist to it. It's modern day. It's enemies to lovers, which, man, is so much fun. The zingers that are turning up is brilliant. So I've kind of had that in my head for a while. So that's fun, but it's parceling up the time that I have between the two. So there's all the kind of structural building work going on. And then there's the thing that I feel like I'm kind of playing with, although I still have to do a certain number of words every day to make it work.
Sure.
So it's been quite nice to have the two, but at the same time, my brain doesn't, I don't know what day it is. I don't know where I'm at. I know this isn't different from normal. Yes.
Well, I know what you mean, because I've been finally finishing the edits with the publishers and the lovely, lovely editor, Sarah, for Alan Shaw 3 as well. So they are now done, and it's with the proofreader.
How do you feel when it goes to proofread stage? There's a good question. I know this is slightly off topic. It's not really topic. We haven't said topic yet, have we, so?
No, we haven't, actually. Writers off topic. We get off topic before we even get to the topic.
The topic is a dot to us. Is that right?
No, that's a Friends reference. It feels weird. It feels super, super weird to be saying goodbye to Alan.
This is it for Alan, is this?
This is done, yeah. I'm absolutely done.
Because how many years have you had Alan in your life?
It's got to be like 5 years or something like that. There's three books and then all of the side stories that have been in, like, anthologies.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that. So the ones that only a few people know exist. Only the hardcore fans have read all of the Alan Shaws and the side stories.
That means people can discover it. So if you've yet to discover Alan Shaw, get in on books one and two and then hunt out all the extra world-building-y stories.
You make it sound way better than it is.
We need to get onto a podcast, don't we, really?
Should we tell people what we're supposed to be talking about?
We're talking about this week, right?
This episode. We are going to talk about Book Fair Week.
Yep.
Two reasons. The first one is that there has been a little bit of controversy on Twitter, and we've been chatting about it, and I've realised I know nothing about it.
Hey.
So I would like Miranda to tell me exactly what the hell it is. And then after that, our daft question of the week is, if you could be in a relationship with any of your characters, who would it be?
Oh, that's a humdinger of a question.
I'm going to struggle with this one.
It doesn't say what kind of relationship.
No, it does just, that's true. It does just say
who
relationship.
Who would be your boss? Who would you like to be the boss of? There you go, it's a different one.
Can you imagine trying to be Alan's boss?
Alan's careers advisor for now he's finished his series. What's going to happen next?
Alan's career advisor hit the bottle as soon as he walked out of the room.
He's still in counselling now.
He is, yeah.
Yes.
So that is our episode. So without further ado, because I don't walk in the same circles as Miranda, we're two very different authors. We work in very different ways. Miranda's always on top of stuff, like in the what I call like the official author world. But that means I don't know what like Book Fair Week is and stuff like that. I have no idea.
I will regale you. Well, it's because I think world events in recent years have meant that there are certain areas of Twitter that you escape to for some kind of sanity.
Absolutely.
So Book Twitter is normally, if you are ever wondering what's going on or you want to talk to other writers, there's very often if you search the hashtag book Twitter, like Bookstagram on Instagram, you can find a lot of positivity, loads of people sharing books that they like, great recommendations for other books, lots of authors pretending to be working but they're really just writing tweets and kind of me too, that's why I'm there. So you see a lot of that stuff going on and that's great. The problem is that if that becomes kind of your, I'll see what's happening like on Book Twitter and that's fine,
Sure.
During a book fair week, all the publishers are talking about deals that are being done. So every year, certainly in adult fiction, there are two major fairs every year. There's the Frankfurt Book Fair, which has just happened. Right. And there's the London Book Fair, which is, I think, start of next year. Oh, I doubt, sometime. They just kind of, they come on you. When you like least expect it, they just sort of jump up on you. And what happens is...
It's a bit like the TARDIS arriving in your town.
Yeah, but not
at
right.
some point, probably should happen because all the time and space is right there. Yeah. But you never really know when it's going to happen.
Yeah, and they turn around and go, oh, it's the TARDIS. But that would be fun. That would be fun because that suggests an adventure, whereas this is just a lot of marketing. It's kind of like, I get the feeling, I have never been, they actually kind of actively discourage writers from going, because also it's like, oh, we'll come down to London Book Fair, and you can see them going, oh, don't have to do that, it's fine. So you see lots of photos. Yeah. You see lots of photos of stands and lots of desks, and it's supposed to be where deals are done and publishers all come together and they talk about the books that they're excited about for the next year, 18 months, and they talk to other publishers for like foreign rights, TV rights, all of that stuff. This is how it's supposed to be.
It's not really for readers to attend or writers to attend.
Not for readers.
It's
no, because you think industry thing. It's an industry thing. So it's the chance when major deals are supposed to be done. This is that's what it's supposed to be. What it seems to me is it is a lot of people go to show face and to be seen. It's like a trade show. It's basically like a trade show. And it's set up as such.
Okay.
So lots of people talk about it. Lots of people in publishing will talk about it because especially in Frankfurt, like they're off there for like 4 or 5 days or whatever, because it runs over 3 days and you've got to go either side of it. And obviously in recent years it's not happened because of COVID. Even last year, the last minute, it was kind of cancelled because there were so many people were getting poorly and all of that stuff. So there is that thing. It's a little bit like, I guess it's a bit like the Comic-Con type thing where you get people coming, or Yalk, which does a lot of like young, like YA stuff that always happens at Comic-Con in London every year. And so there is this idea that all the big books that are going to be really big in the next sort of a year, 18 months, 2 years, are going to be mentioned. So all of the agencies go there, all of the publishers, big and small publishers can go there. And what they tend to do is that they save up all of the deals that they've done up until that point, like for months sometimes. But they always act like they've just signed a deal. And it seems like everybody is signing seven-figure deals. It's kind of like forward marketing, I think, for the books that they really want to push. So they will hang on to those announcements and then announce them, bang, 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 for a week. Supposedly all been happening at the book fair. It's a load of bobbins. It's gone on for a long time. It's their chance to do kind of, like I say, forward marketing, get people, get a buzz happening, all of that stuff. It's interesting from an author's point of view because you can see the kind of things that publishers are taking on, although you never write to the market, because even if you're a really fast writer, by the time you get there, it's something else.
I think it's a dangerous game to play that. I know people who do it, and I know people who do it well.
Yeah.
But for me...
You get lucky, I think. I don't think it ever really...
I think some people have dropped on. Yeah.
Also because a lot of the things, the irony is that the publishing industry can say what it likes. The big books that take the world by storm are always driven by readers. Always driven by readers.
Every single time.
50 Shades is the classic example that's very often mentioned, where it was word of mouth. And whatever you thought of the book, I love the fact that it was readers that put it there. These things are useful. They're useful to find out about. It's interesting to know what's going on. Yeah, like it's like I watched the announcement about the Booker Prize thing just because it was interesting to know who'd win. I didn't like all the stuff that had gone before where they'd been really snotty about dinner ladies. Oh, apparently there's some people in the reading group who are dinner ladies. it was a really bad run step. But for the authors that were nominated, I wanted to find out who won because I thought it was quite nice to see that, right?
Of course.
I love the fact that the guy who won, it's brilliant. I just, for that point, I was like, I will actually buy the book now, probably, because he's great. But he got up and he was like, I've only got 2 minutes, like I've just won the Booker Prize, can I have a bit longer? And then he said, I love all the people on the shortlist. I think you're brilliant. I'd like to share this, I'd really like to share this award with you. It belongs to all of us, but I'll hang on to the money if you don't mind. And I was like, yes, my kind of author that is.
Yeah, that's great, man. I mean, I pay attention to the Stoker Prize for obvious reasons.
Obviously,
But I don't the rest, to be honest.
It's interesting to see that stuff. And that's great. It's interesting to see new books that are coming out from a bookworm point of view.
Absolutely. Whenever I look at the Stoker Prize, my to read pile goes exponentially through the roof.
Interesting to see where they're going, interesting to see what publishers are looking for. The problem can be that because of the amount of energy that is expended talking about this stuff, talking about these deals, only mentioning the deals that are biggest. If you are a writer and you haven't got something big to announce and you're stuck, as I was this week, in the middle of editing hell and you're questioning everything that you do and you're not announcing a seven-figure deal. Because when they say seven-figure as well, it very often isn't seven-figure. Like I would say, seven-figure if you include like four decimal places.
Yes. I was going to say, if I can tack on some decimals onto the end of my name.
If you are struggling and all you see on Twitter is all of these authors who are presumably doing better than you. Now, it's not about jealousy, because it's not. It's just the amount of stuff that comes across with all these people who are celebrating things, except these things haven't. These things have been coming on for months and months and months, and they're just all announcing it now to make it look like they're doing business. And then hopefully they're trying to attract business by doing that. But if you're an author, you can end up feeling A, left behind, B, a complete failure. If you're already struggling, then that can be incredibly disheartening. Somebody posted on Twitter, just so you know, not like the only reason they're talking about seven-figure deals is they are so rare. It shows it happens and it's great, but a lot of it is rhetoric. A lot of it isn't real. But I think that's the thing. I think particularly when you're writing, really when you're really at the coal face and you're really writing and every step forward seems to take forever to see what looks like somebody flying. Seven-figure deals and nine different territories that have bought it and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But like the very reason you're hearing about it is that it doesn't happen to everybody, because if it happened to everybody, you'd be like, oh, there's just another one. And then when it's a celebrity who's never written anything in their lives but has 2.4 million followers on Instagram or TikTok, it's hard. It's really hard. So that was why we were talking about it being, I said it's bobbins. A lot of it is. It's all, it's done as a marketing thing. It's not done.
Sure, yeah.
But it looks like it's done on merit, and it's not.
It's verging on toxic publishing.
Yes.
You know? Yes. I feel like there's a lack of self-awareness in the effect that they're having on the people who are doing the first line job.
Certainly.
Which is the actual writing.
Yeah.
And then obviously that huge wealth of team that helps you actually get your book finished and things like that. But fundamentally, it's having a negative effect on the people who are doing that first line work, which is dangerous. And it's a real shame.
I think there's a huge problem with it in the industry. And they're finally addressing it in terms of people who work in publishing and the burnout and the expectation and the relatively low wages that they're being paid. And there is a lot of exploitation that goes on. And there's a lot of this is the dream job. You've got to work for no money to do it.
Dangerous.
At the same time, there is very little recognition by the industry that that is essentially what they do to authors.
Yes.
Because there was an author this week who's written loads, and her books are amazing. And she said, what's the word for when your book that you've worked on for a year comes out and 2 weeks after that you get a letter from your editor saying how disappointed they are in sales?
I saw that as well. Yeah. In fact, I actually answered that. I don't do this very often. I'm very much a sit back and don't engage. I'm a lurker. Yeah. I'm a terrible lurker. But that one, actually, I really felt for her. And I actually did end up replying to that one.
Oh, no, well, I did. I bought the book as well. Is that loads of authors went and bought the book. And
solidarity.
Because people are going, everyone's been there. Everybody's had that email. Everyone's had that phone call. That shrug. When there's things that are at work that aren't anything to do with you and writing the book, but somehow it's your gig when it goes wrong. And there's a lot of that. And it's not just in the publishing industry, that happens in the music industry a lot.
The important word there is industry, isn't it?
Yeah. Anything where you've got managers and then you've got the people actually doing the job. There is always that disconnect between the two. I think publishing has, because it hasn't been challenged by anything for a long time, really.
Yes.
The actual working practices haven't. I think the pandemic has. And now they are talking about editors who are burning out and people who are leaving the industry in their droves because they literally just get burned up and chucked out. What they're not talking about is the huge amount of authors that have done
that. I'm hoping that will trickle down.
I hope so. I think people are actually talking about it now. Because even 10 years ago, I don't think you would have had a tweet like that where somebody just went, you wouldn't have done sod it, I'm just going to say it.
The other thing is as well, sometimes, I don't know if you feel the same way about it, but sometimes I feel like if I post something honest about either the work I'm doing or my experiences with publishing or an event or something like that, what I'm trying to do is say to everybody else out there who, you know, all three people who follow me on Twitter, say, you know, sometimes this happens, folks. Just be aware of it. Don't let it get you down.
Yeah.
But I think there's still a lot of people that feel like they can't express negativity.
Yeah.
Because to do so makes you look like maybe you're ungrateful or something like that. There's still a lot of that going on. So it's nice when someone takes a stand and goes, actually, guys, you know, this isn't really the way it works. That's really important that we have people brave enough to do that. I am not one of them. It's good that we have them.
Sometimes you have to. In all my time on Twitter, I did two consecutive tweets that just went, what the hell? I wasn't specific. I'd come back from a funeral.
I remember this.
And found out that a decision had been made that I hadn't been consulted on, which was then going to impact me massively financially. I read it at 1 o'clock in the morning. I told myself I wouldn't check my emails. I did. The only outlet I had was to say something on Twitter because I was hoping that somebody might be... Or you just, so you feel like you're saying something because everybody was in bed here and I had to, and I did it and I had people accusing me of sabotaging my career. I had the,
that's why
my ruby slippers are pinching. There's 40 million other authors who would happily jump into your shoes. I'm like, really? Like, I don't think they would. But there is,
that's the first thing that people say.
And it's really hard. It's like, it is like intimidation. It's a little bit of intimidation.
Absolutely. That's optics, though, isn't it? Because that is how people perceive. I perceive you in exactly the same way. So here we go, folks. Here's what I'm going to say. So I know I say this all the time, but I see Miranda as the real deal. As far as I'm concerned.
And you are too, Craig Hallam.
She's levels above. You know, she does the thing. She does it every year. She releases these books every year. She's like, she's consistent. She's got all these great readers. Sunday Times bestseller, folks. All this kind of stuff. And I'm like, God, that is so cool. But then I also know you. So I get the reality. But I get the reality behind it. But I'm very aware that if I was on Twitter following Miranda Dickinson or MJ White, or any of your other
people follow me as MJ White, they don't know who this is.
That I would be thinking, God, ew, my ruby slippers are pinching, as you say, like, oh, you know, she's complained about a thing, but look how awesome she's doing, and blah, blah, blah. Fundamentally, there's still a person behind the name, and I think every author out there, unless they are one of the, like, 0.5% or whatever that are making millions, are just trying to write their stuff. They want people to read it and enjoy it, and they want to pay their bills and feed their kids.
The difference is that if you're working in an actual job as opposed to a weird writer job, which just doesn't bear any resemblance to anything like logical or anything, is that you wouldn't get every time you open your emails, there's news of someone else getting more money than you. There isn't that focus in normal industries. I mean, yes, you hear about people getting pay rises and stuff, but it's not relentless. And two times a year, every day for a week, and every email you get, and every, because there's roundups and it's news and it's the big time and all that. And so I think it's just trying to stay grounded in that is really hard.
Absolutely.
I mean, the reason that I'm Wordsmith on Twitter and not Miranda Dickinson author is so that I can talk about anything. And so I don't have to just talk about books all the time, because people would unfollow really fast if all I did was like, buy my book.
That's something we should talk about in depth, actually, the balance.
I'm going to post 9 pictures of kittens, and then in the middle I'm going to go, buy my book, in a subliminal message halfway through.
Yeah, I do it like once every 6 months or something, and then feel guilty for the next 6 months.
But you're made to feel that way. There's this ironic thing that you've got to talk all the time about how positive it is and what you're doing and pictures of your screen and all the research you're doing and all of that exciting stuff and be up all the time, and you have a really bad day. Like the number of times when I used to run Write Foxy, the actual event days, the number of times that something horrific had happened to me professionally the day before, and I had to stand up and tell everybody how brilliant it was to be an author. It just happened with such alarming regularity that it got to be hilarious. It was like, all right, well, you know, I've got this author event on Saturday where I'm talking about how brilliant it is to be an author, I wonder what catastrophe is going to befall me on Friday.
It's going to happen the night before.
But what text am I going to get an hour before I go on stage, you know, and that kind of thing. But it's this weird thing of like, you've got an author brand and you've got to be a certain way. And even if, like, I try to be as honest as I can be.
I was going to say, my brand is not a brand at all.
No, but there's always a point where you just go, should I post this? Can I reword it? Like, I still worry about how that comes across.
Yeah.
And it's taken a long time to get to the stage of not apologising for that.
You should never have to apologise for your honesty. You can't expect people to agree with you.
I am not the fountain of knowledge on anything except maybe like kids shows from the 1980s.
You are good at that, actually.
I'm pretty good at that. I tell you what, I'm really random, completely stupid, like won't ever win anything in a pub quiz. But I can identify people by voiceovers in commercials.
That's actually pretty decent.
That's somebody who sounds like that person, but it's not actually that person. When I first came into the industry, I knew no one. I didn't know any other authors. I was on an online group where everybody was going, I've got no idea either. That was it.
Online was a brand new thing.
Yeah. I found a photo the other day because I was talking about my first book, Fairy Tale of New York, which, you know, kind of was a word of mouth thing and did really, really well and was a real kismet moment. Never happened since. But it was that one that got me the Sunday Times bestseller, which I can then use everything. It's like an Oscar nomination.
I've done exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, Down Days, my one non-fiction does really well and goes, and goes bestseller. I still put bestselling author on the front.
Yeah, I found a photo that was the first photo taken of me holding my book. And it got nominated for a Romantic Novelist Association Award, which is like the Oscars in the romance world. The RNA are, they're the industry group for romantic fiction. And it got nominated for Novel of the Year. Now, I mean, I don't even know how I've done this. I'm trying to write book 2 and I think I'm rubbish. I had to go down to London for a press shoot, except that no one from the press turned up, which is pretty much like that happens a lot. But in this kind of, I had to find my way down to London. I had to like book the day off work. I had to borrow the money from my mum because I still hadn't been paid because the book hadn't officially come out. It had only just come out and I did, you know, all that sort of stuff. And there's a photo of me and the outfit that I'm wearing. It was my mum's cardigan. It was over the only dress that I had that I used to use for gigging that had a massive hole in it. So I borrowed my mum's cardigan to go over the top. I have no makeup on. I did my hair in the loose when I got there because it was raining and I walked in looking like a bedraggled rat. And everybody else who'd come in, they'd stayed overnight. They were a lot of them were London based. A lot of them had been writing for a really long time as well. I was the only debut author that was on the list. They'd all gone and got their hair done in the morning. Some of them had one lady had a makeup artist there, and she's there. And I walked in like, all right, everybody, feeling like I was kind of the urchin they'd let in off the street. Like someone asked me to hold their drink for them at one point because they honestly didn't think I looked like an author. And it's really funny that photo was used
so
many times.
Interesting, because you didn't look like an author. What does an author even look like?
An author, in their sense, looked like someone who was wearing designer style. I caught the tube. I didn't even get a taxi that time. Yeah, I couldn't afford a taxi. Because it was, you know, before the mist of time, I didn't have a map on my phone. So I'm asking Evening Standard sellers on the way down because they generally can tell you where you're going. They're quite surprised when you talk to them because that's quick to anyone talking to them. And this is the only way that I could get down. Got in at the last minute. Everybody was already there. My face was bright red because I'm normally magnolia. So the moment there's any kind of colour in my face, I look like I'm dying. I'm feeling like the biggest imposter in the world. Nobody was taking me seriously. Why have they been nominated for this award? But you see that photo and it's like she's at this swanky awards reception, and because it's all about how it's perceived, and it's all a lot of it's bobbins. My favorite word for the last week.
I don't think I would ever be comfortable with being that level of, you know, the designer clothes wearing author that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever be comfortable with that because it's not really me. I imagine myself as an 1800s boheme author who nobody ever reads. He's wearing hand-me-downs and he lives in someone's hayloft. That's my kind of vibe. I love that vibe.
I want to be the little old lady that wears tweed skirts and takes her 4 million little dogs for a walk in between, but can actually afford a pension. And
I mean, that is a dream.
All the thing with Book Fair Week, bringing it back to Book Fair Week, it's all about how you see yourself and the kind of completely ridiculous and attainable standards we set for ourselves. And it's absolutely, it's pitched, the moment you say anything, it's pitched as writer jealousy. Oh, there's some people being really bitter about the fact that people have got things. No, that's not why I posted it. I posted because I said, if you're having a tough week, your writing still matters. And more importantly, you still matter. Just because somebody's turned around and said they don't want that, which is the hardest thing ever, because however you dress it up, a rejection feels like a rejection of you. We call it rejections. We don't say a pass. There's this kind of like awful romanticized myth of a struggling artist. It's like, no, actually, people should actually be paid. If the people are paid a living wage for what they were doing, not huge seven-figure sums, none of that bobbins, because it's all rubbish. If your people are paid so they didn't have to worry about bills, in the sense that you get a job to cover your bills, right? If you had that, they just think of the creativity that could be unleashed when people's minds absolutely are not taken over by, I've got enough for this month, but next month I don't know what I'm going to do because I have no money due in, and yet I've got five different bits of work to do that I might not get paid for a year.
Let's get philosophical, folks. The thing is, for instance, me, I wouldn't need much from my books to replace the fact that I work. So yeah. I am a minimum wage librarian, folks.
Yeah.
That is what I do. I've been a nurse. I've been an undertaker. Now I'm a minimum wage librarian because it gives me time to do the things that I really want to do. It would not take much if I could have the freedom to be able to write every day.
Yeah,
my output would go exponentially.
Yeah, the irony is that the creators of art and storytellers and the musicians and the people that are actually creating stuff that people consume, that people turn to in times like lockdown, when book sales soar and people go back to brilliant TV shows and films that they've loved for years and find music and find comfort in that, we don't see it as being an important thing. The people working in the industries that it does pay their bills for, it's absolutely see it, but they see us as a commodity and we let them. So it is, I know that sounds like we're getting really serious, but honestly, I think this is what I've said in recent months. I've kind of really tried to set boundaries and really, really go, no, actually it's worth more than that. It's worth
That's really important.
That.
Yeah.
It's partly because I think creatives, we're generally not very organized people. I think if you, this is why I'm impressed now. You said this about like how you see me, how I see you. To be able to not just look at what you're writing, but how you're going to market it, where it's going to go, to self-publish. All my life, I am so scared about the idea of that. To work with smaller publishers, but actually then put the legwork in, have an idea of how you want the marketing strategy to be. Everything that you do has to be tailored beyond the actual writing of it. I think that's brilliant. I think it's amazing. The vast amount of people that are creatives are not that organized. That's why being in a band is always a nightmare if one of the musicians person that's doing the bookings, because very quickly you find they can't be bothered. Like they've got something else on their mind that they just haven't done anything with. So the problem is we need people to organize us and sell what we're doing.
Absolutely. But
because we are settling for less and less and less. And the industry has learned this. They do the well, of course, you're very lucky.
This is glorification of the struggling author as well, isn't it?
It's glamorous.
The struggling artist, should I say. You know, like you were saying earlier, musicians, artists, poets, writers,
filmmakers,
yes. But unless you're struggling, unless you've had to fight every step of the way to get where you're going, you're not legitimate, which is madness.
I
didn't fight to go work in my library. I just learned what to do and then went and moved some books around. You know, nobody says that I had to be a struggling nursing assistant before I got to be a nurse. I mean, I was a struggling nursing assistant first. But you don't have to be. I just went to school, I got my degree, and then I went and I was a nurse. Nobody patted me on the head and said I'm supposed to be here because I struggled first. But there is still that thing with artists. It's odd.
Nobody would choose to sit down and do this for hundreds of hours if they saw the pay packet first. You're going to do this, but you might get paid twice a year, and then it'll be like half of it you'll lose in tax. And
one of the questions I get asked the most at signings and things like that, you know, when you're doing talks, you're like, go on then, Q&A, why not? What have you got? Hit me with your best shot. The amount of times I've been asked just straight up by someone, how much do you earn?
Oh, Oh, yeah. All the time. Does it pay well? I'm standing here in my mum's cardigan because I've got a hole in the thing.
A hole in my dress, yeah.
And I just got changed in the loo. So does that answer your question?
Previously, in a talk, I went, tell you what, I'm going to show you the bottom of my boots.
Yeah.
And this guy went, because I usually turn out relatively all right. I try to, you know, look the part. However, if you look at the soles of my boots, you will see that there are holes straight through to my socks.
Yeah.
Because shoes are expensive, man. And it's that's exactly the same thing. I'm stood up there, people looking in a waistcoat, and I'm kind of talking like I know what I'm talking about, and I don't. Yeah. But then I said, I'm going to show you the bottom of my boots. And I just kind of went, there you go. That's the reality right there, is I can't afford any shoes.
You see, my my shoes that I wear for every author thing, although I haven't done recently, I've just go with boots and trainers, like sneakers, because they're just comfortable. But yeah, when I used to go do the heel thing, in fact, I think the very first time we met, I put heels on to do the talk, and then I'd got sneakers. I got my supermarket Converse that aren't gone.
By the time we were tea dueling, you'd gone back to sneakers.
I'd gone back to sneakers. But those ones, they're supposed to look like velvet, like black velvet, but they're not. Ooh. I've had them for a very long time, and they are my gig shoes. So they're what I use for doing when I was doing wedding gigs. But before every performance, I had to have a black felt tip pen in my bag, and I had to colour in all the bits that had faded.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was fine as long as it didn't rain, and then there's just like little black puddles everywhere. Like, what's this on the floor?
This is why I wear black. I mean, it's not some high-end Johnny Cash reference. I wear black because it's... Well, I love the colour, but it's easy. I'm colourblind. I can't see colour if I wanted to.
Yeah.
So I just end up looking like a circus clown if I tried to wear colours. I feel only good when I wear black.
I get my colour from a hat. But the reason that I started wearing hats was because very often I'd come straight from work and I hadn't washed my hair. Because for the first, when my book was signed, I was living in a rented one-bedroom flat, and it hadn't had a proper shower the whole time I was there. In fact, I got a shower just before I left, like for the next lot of people, they'd put it in. But I had, you know, do you ever used to have those little the attachment when you were a kid that went on the bath taps that had a little thing?
With the rubber end.
With the rubber end. And every now and again, if you put the water pressure on too far, it used to go... And it was like Cleopatra and the asp, like trying to hang on to this thing. That was what my shower was. So very often, I've not had any hot water, so I hadn't washed my hair, so I put my hat on. So that's why I ended up wearing hats, because you can't see what the top of my... how greasy the top of my hair is. But this is what I mean, is that you can't take anything at face value. You can't take anything you see on social media at face value. Focus on the things that you've got control over, and you just ignore the stuff you can't. Well, you try your best to ignore the stuff. It's hard, but it's try your best to ignore the stuff that you have no control over. So much of your life as an author, whether you are self-published, whether you're traditionally published, whether you're waiting to be published, is out of your control. Life is out of your control generally. The thing that you have control over is the next word and the next word and the next word. That's all you've got. And so enjoy that and make the most of it and share the journey and be honest and don't fall for all the marketing bobbins, because really it's almost like it's in a different language and we don't speak that language, so we don't have to worry about it. But it's hard when you're constantly bombarded by it. So that was my point about book fairs, is that no one really knows what goes on. I suspect there's a lot of like jollying that goes on, and then they're kind of, that's why the story at the press release is to make it look like they've done something.
Sure.
Yeah, everyone's had a job where you've done that, you know, like, I've worked really hard this afternoon, here's all the stuff I did this morning.
Do you remember when we had a fun question that we were going to answer as well?
Have we got a fun question? What's our fun question this week?
The tech question this week, Miranda, is, if you could be in a relationship with any of your characters, who would it be? I imagine this might be quite tough for you, especially as you write romance a lot. So you are quite romantically minded about most of your characters, I'm assuming.
I am by the end, but like a lot of them, because I tend to write quite flawed characters, so some of them are like, they are idiots for a lot of the time.
Absolute douches, yeah. You have written a couple and I've gone, God, this guy.
And they have, yeah, but do you know what? Those are the ones that people go, I don't understand why she didn't end up with him. And it's like, that says a lot more about you than it is about my book. Mm-hmm. I have to give the official answer.
Okay.
The official answer is that Bob is the role model for all of my male love interests in my book who are lovely, and therefore I am in a relationship with my character. Does that sound official enough? Okay.
I swear on Sculbert's life. Right.
It's serious. Sculbert.
Sculbert is right here, right? I swear.
Yeah.
On Sculbert's punk rock haircut.
Yeah.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing about one of the characters in Alan Shaw. I was just about to say Lottie is based heavily on Laura.
Oh.
And so that's obviously the right choice. And then I was going to say, but actually.
Yeah. We are cut from the same cloth.
There's only us here.
And 200 listeners.
Come on, who is it really? Come on, give us the real insight.
Well, in terms of published books that are actually published, not ones that are waiting to be published, is probably Jack from Somewhere Beyond the Sea. So that is set in Cornwall. It's about he's a widower. But he's a widower. So this is, you know what you're saying about orphans? Widowers is another thing. That like widowers that have this tragic, they've lost their life, the wife in a tragic circumstance. It's not a spoiler in my book to say that he'd fallen out with his wife. He was at the point of leaving her on the day that he was going to leave her, she dies of an aneurysm that no one sees coming. So everyone is expecting him to be this kind of tragic, he lost the love of his life, when actually it was a really hard situation. And then she leaves them in a really hard situation because she was 32 and had no life insurance. And so suddenly he's stuck, or he's in this situation, not of his choosing. Obviously it's awful that she's died, but then he's there with his little girl who he's desperately trying to provide for. And he's suddenly financially, he's lost the house. They're living in a little chalet on a caravan park that his mate has lent him that leaks when it rains. Like, it's just, it's not the, I'll never live again because I had my first love. He's not like that at all.
Yeah.
But he has a real gallows sense of humour, which I love.
I was going to say, what's the part about him that you really love?
Yeah, because it sounds like that's not the things that we love about him right now. No, that he wants his daughter to have magic, and he rails against the fact that he has to be a grown-up. And so the very fact that they're in this real ramshackled old kind of little chalet, they're in constant fear that the guy who owns the caravan park is going to want it back in the summer. So they think they might be homeless, but it means he can take her down on the beach every night. And they start making stars out of sea glass pieces, which is then what the lady finds in the morning. So they do that at night. She comes down in the morning to walk her dog and she completes the stars. And so they're playing this game where someone is completing their stars for him, and he loves the magic side of it. His daughter is convinced it's mermaids. He's not going to disabuse her of that. So it was all about being a great dad. And it was at the time when I'd lost my dad. So there was a lot of stuff, which I didn't realize until afterwards, which was all that my dad hated the fact that he had to have a proper job. He worked insurance for 40 years and he hated it, but he did it because he wanted to provide for his family. And he'd come from a situation where he'd had to like stop bailiffs coming to the door when he was 5 and his little brother was 3. And like he'd had that thing. And so he was like, no child of mine's gonna have to do that. But he was happiest when he was mucking about, doing silly voices, doing the thing, you know, like we had a hatch from our living room to the kitchen, and he did the thing of like going up down in a lift and the escalator and all the goon stuff. Classics. He would do that. The thing that I love the most about my dad is that in where he got given early retirement at 56 and basically told that he wasn't important anymore. Then he got into being a TV and film extra and just lived his best life for the next 20 years, appearing in all kinds of things, always like his shoulder, back of his head, you know, occasionally his hand. So sometimes we see his face. But he got the chance to be that kid and do all that stuff that he'd never had. And so I think that came out in Jack. And so that's probably, I would say you always marry your dad, but you know, it's that sort of thing of, he resents the fact that he's having to be a grown-up and worry about money, when really all he wants to do is muck about on the beach with his little girl and talk about mermaids. And he doesn't want her to have to deal with real life as well. And it's a real like proper dad, like a good, lovely, caring dad who's basically just a kid who wants to be a kid. And so I think that's who I'd choose. And also because of his attitude to everything is literally like, I've got to laugh because it's just scary. 24/7, it's scary. And you know, it's that he has this dream about what he wants to do and the kind of life he wants to provide. And it is literally, he wants to give her her own bedroom because she hasn't got it at the moment. And like, it's not huge, I want to earn millions and millions of pounds. He wants to build things. He wants to build houses. He wants to use stuff that he finds in Cornwall which is Cornwall matters to him because it's where he was brought up, and he wants to kind of celebrate that, and he just wants magic in his life, sort of thing. So I think that's a really long answer, sorry, but that's who I choose. How about you?
No, that's good though, because we've got a real sense of character from that. I feel like mine's not going to be that in depth. So the person from, oh god, this is so hard. Right, this is really tough, and I'll tell you why it's tough. And it's because of the kind of characters that I write. I absolutely love writing complete and utter pieces of work with as few redeeming features as possible. And or, you know, they're kind of damaged beyond repair and things like that. Or they're like dead, or okay, they're, you know, or things like that. Because, you know, I write weird stuff, don't I?
Yeah.
I think... See, there's a few. Lottie, obviously, from Alan Shaw.
Yes.
Because she's based on Laura, is obviously has parts that I absolutely love. Again, from the Alan Shaw series, again, Mary, who everybody else seems to love as well.
Oh, yeah.
Has this, mostly because she's a real foil for Alan's BS.
Yes.
And when he has nothing, absolutely nothing left...
Yeah.
And he's destroyed everything he thought about himself, any kind of semblance of love that he had for his own personality, and the one thing that he thought he was good at, which was, you know, being this privateer, being this adventurer, being the guy who always, like, gets the goal and, you know, that kind of thing. It turns out that he can't just bumble through that, and he needs to think, because he can kill people. Mary comes along and, you know, she's thrown at him, and he's not given a choice, because he's given a partner. He's given a partner for a job. He can't fly planes. He hates planes. He hates horses. He hates anything that moves that he isn't in control of.
Yeah.
It freaks him out. So he's never learned to fly. But, you know, Mary's a pilot, and a very good one as well. So he's kind of thrown with this partner, and there's a little bit of kind of chemistry there.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun to write. But yeah, she doesn't put up with any of his crap.
It's a sign of someone that's right for someone, I think.
Absolutely.
If they're just like,
he will say something and she will instantly kind of give him a look like, really? And quite often she'll go, you know, I know you, right? Like, I've met you. I know that's rubbish. And they'll go, ah, oh, damn it. Yeah. He can't get away with it. She really grounds him. She makes him think, which is something that he has a real issue with. And after their first meeting, this kind of chemistry builds up in the first story, and they do actually end up sleeping together. But the next morning, he realizes what a huge mistake he's made.
Oh.
And he says to her, I know we were both overexcited because we got the job done. And don't get me wrong, it was great, but I really need a friend.
Oh.
And she says, absolutely, that's no problem. I can be a friend. And from there on in, it's just pure platonic love between these two people.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's always there to support him and tell him he's an idiot, you know, and anytime she needs him, he's absolutely there. They're completely locked in. They're just not together. And
yeah,
I really love writing. I mean, I don't think you can really call it platonic, because they do have that mistake moment where they actually
it's the potential thing, isn't it? Simmering away, and they're both aware of it, and then they both choose not to do anything about it. Is absolute catnip for readers.
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah.
I don't care if it was a mistake. It clearly wasn't. Yeah.
Most of the questions from book two, nobody cares about Alan anymore. Everybody wants to know if Mary's coming back in book three, because she leaves, she gets married, she finds somebody else at the end of book two, and she goes to Africa with this guy. He's a doctor, and she goes to basically fly his flying hospital with him and save people in the desert, stuff like that. But literally every question I ever get is Mary coming back for book three? So I think everybody loves Mary a little bit.
Do you get them? I've got to be careful how I say this, because I don't know how this will come across. Shipping, they're called, aren't they? Relationshipping. I just got to say it, because we are a clean podcast, and sometimes...
Shipping.
Do you get a lot of people doing that? Ships.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Alan and Mary, massively. That was the one thing. The lady who came to me after book two, at a sign-in, and told me how book three had to go. And I mean, she went, right, book three's got to go like this. Otherwise, you know, it's not gonna end very well. It's gotta go this way. He's got to have a happy ending. She wanted him to get together with Rani at first, but who's the love interest for the first book. She's got to come back. We've got to have a happy ending.
Oh, the redemption
ending,
thing.
You know, all this kind of thing. Or maybe Mary. Oh, him and Mary are perfect for each other. And, you know, she's coming back in book three. She was really excited about it. And in the end, she was so excited for the fact that Alan was going to have a wonderful, happy ending and kind of ride off into the sunset. I actually had to say to her, you probably don't want to read book three. She went, what? I don't think you're going to enjoy it. Really, I don't. Ooh. Read to the end of book two.
Leave him in your
have
head.
Have that wonderful, warm feeling. I'm really glad you enjoyed it up to that point. I love the fact you loved it so much that you care what happens next. But you are going to hate book three.
That's a great question.
Maybe Mary.
Yeah.
There is another one from Ocean Varna Complex. So that's the cyberpunk one, folks, that I very rarely talk about.
Brilliant. Buy it.
VT from Ocean Varna Complex for me. I wrote them as a... I wanted that moment. So there's a lot of 80s inspiration in cyberpunk, in Ocean Varna Complex, but in cyberpunk anyway. And I really wanted to lean into that. And there's a moment when they walk into this disco. I'm going to call it a disco, not a club, because I feel like disco is the right word to use.
You're different,
and everybody is logged into each other, so they're only listening to the music they want to listen to. There's no music actually playing.
The like silent disco thing that you've got now.
But if you tap someone else's node on their neck, you can connect and you can listen to their music. Zev spots someone literally in a crowd, strobes are going off, and it's like that crowd party in an 80s movie, and there's somebody dancing there, and they see VT, and it's this instant oh my god. And it's that, you know, it's just that eye meeting thing. I think sometimes people are and their eyes met across a room. You know, there's nothing more romantic than somebody looking at someone from a distance and you make a connection without even talking to each other.
Absolutely.
So everybody who doesn't like eyes meeting across a crowded room can at me, and I will fight them on a hill for it. But anyway, so VT was very much, you know, they've got this like long green hair kind of down one side or kind of shaved down the other.
Yeah.
And they're wearing like this like sequin top thing, and like the strobes are going off and there's all this light, and it's and Zev lives in a very dark kind of dingy kind of place, and then VT is just this pulse of light. But it's their philosophy as well, and they just have this great perspective, and I really like smart people and philosophical people. So I think me and V probably go on.
That's such a cool question though. I love that.
Thank you, by the way, for the question to Rachel Rogers, who is
a very old
friend of mine. Me and Rach share the same birthday, but she is a year older than me, which I will never ever let her forget.
Oh, I can imagine. You're a nightmare with that guy, Callum.
But yeah, we've known each other. We know each other since school. So yeah, thanks for that. She did give us another one, which we'll save for another time.
Yes, but, brilliant. If you have a question that you would like us to hedge around, maybe occasionally touch on in this podcast, if you've got a question you'd like to ask us, then there's a number of ways you can ask us the question. I'm going to do it, Craig. I love this bit.
Trillions, millions, squillions.
You can find us on the socials. I am Wordsmith. Craig is Craig Hallam 84, which is the number of times I've got him talking about his books in this episode.
Well done.
You can also contact us with that on Instagram and on Twitter. You can also email us, writersofftopic@gmail.com, all lowercase, no spaces.
Excellent.
Yeah, ask us a question. If you are on Patreon and you're a patron on Patreon.
Nicely done. You did it. Yeah.
Oh, it's only taken how many months to get there? You can always ask us. We love your comments. We love your questions. If you've got suggestions for the show, even if it's just like maybe take a bit less time talking about it, then that's
take it down a notch, guys. That'd be great. Or if we've said anything that you agree with or disagree with or want to expand on, then drop us a message, because we're around.
Absolutely.
We try and make ourselves as available as we possibly can. So we do want to chat about this
on social media. So
absolutely.
Anything that you want to talk about, anything you'd like to see in a future show, anything you want to know about us or our books. If you've enjoyed the show, maybe leave us a little review. If you don't enjoy the show, just tell, maybe don't tell anybody. And
just keep it between us.
Yeah, it's fine. We'll consider it our little secret. So get in contact. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about. We will be back very soon with another episode of this epic silliness. Otherwise known as Writers Off Topic. It has been a joy to do this episode. We will have more fun next time. Thank you for listening. Take care and we'll see you soon. Say goodbye, Craig.
Goodbye, Craig.
You've been listening to Writers Off Topic with Craig Hallam and Miranda Dickinson. A Coffee and Roses production, 2023. Support the show at patreon.com/writersofftopic.